some way, we're all engaged in the task of trying to figure out what we want to do in this world.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
How can parents continue to support their homeschooled girls, you know, find mentors or...
There's sort of a philosophical answer to that and a very practical answer. I mean, the philosophical one, in a way, really is embedded right there within that word support that you mentioned, that sometimes, you know, because all of us who have been to school, we're used to thinking that education in many ways is about figuring out what kids need to do and then figuring out ways to get them to do it. That's what, in fact, as colloquial as that sounds, that's what much of discussion of education really is about. You know, what should kids be learning and how can we cleverly devise ways to get them to do it and to get that knowledge actually in there and that sort of thing. And so that's kind of one way of thinking about it. Then when people begin to critique that and question that model and question the effectiveness and so forth, as many, many people have, sometimes there's a tendency to swing to kind of a false other end of a spectrum where the assumption is that in that case you should somehow just entirely leave kids alone. That's, I think, what a very, very superficial and ultimately false understanding of sometimes homeschooling and certainly of some kinds of alternative schools is, you know, that the alternative to making kids do things is sort of nothing at all. And in fact, there is such a profound third alternative to either of those two, either making kids do things or leaving them entirely alone, and that alternative really can be summed up by the word support, where there is quite a role for an adult in the life of a young person who is self-directed and not forced to do things. There is, after all, a whole big world out there, and helping young people to navigate through it, to understand what their options are, to figure out what they want, and to know what's available, there's so much there that an adult can do. And so that then gets into the very practical, that you might be, I'll just take a very specific example, a girl expresses a very general interest in working with animals, let's say. She may not be at all sure what she means by that. She may not be sure what the options would be. One of the things that an adult can do in that situation is, first of all, let her know what the options are, talk to her about how she could be reading about that sort of thing. She could be apprenticing, volunteering with, you know, what does she mean by animals? Does she mean training guide dogs for the blind? Does she mean working in a veterinarian's office? You know, there's so many different things you can do. And sometimes by throwing out those specific scenarios, it's in the conversation with the girl or boy, actually, that they figure out what it is that they really do want. An adult can offer very practical help, like placing the phone call to the veterinarian, you know, to begin to explore those kinds of possibilities. The easiest way to sum this up is actually by the very wise words of some friends of mine run a resource center for young people, and the way they would always pose the question to both from little toddlers right on up through teenagers, they would say, what's the part you can do and what's the part you'd like help with? Which really shows that it's not an all-or-nothing kind of proposition. A young person might say, I really need help with making that initial phone call to the veterinarian, because that's a really scary thing to figure out as a 13-year-old, how I place that cold call to a strange adult and figure out if it's possible to volunteer there. But then once you place the call, Mom, you know, I would be comfortable going to the first appointment by myself, or, you know, whatever it might be. But in other words, the idea that there are parts that young people want our help with and parts they feel able to do themselves, and it's so important not to butt in there and help with the parts that they don't want. You know, think of a toddler saying, no, you know, I want to do it myself, and it's so important not to interfere with that, but it's so important to extend the help and support when young people do want it. That's kind of an overview that I think really shows what kind of help we can offer. We give the help that's asked for, as John Holt put it, and not the help that's not asked for. Role models is an interesting concept. I have a somewhat unusual way of looking at that term or interpreting that term, which is as follows. The thing about what gets me nervous about the concept of role models is the idea that an adult would be doing what he or she did specifically for its effect on a young person. You know, in other words, let's say how that might play out would be an adult saying, you know, I'm going to make a point of doing this so that my child can see that it's important. You're sort of having that pedagogical intent. What I'm interested in is something a little more, this is, sounds a bit jargony perhaps, but a little more authentic than that. In other words, adults should be thinking about what they think is important and what they care about, and then figuring out how to give young people access to that and let young people join in. So that John Holt used to say, very, very classic answer to people who would say, I want to work with kids. John Holt would say, find some work you think is worth doing, and then put your mind to figuring out ways for young people to join you. In some way, we're all engaged in the task of trying to figure out what we want to do in this world. Of all the things that there are, what seems to us to be important, meaningful, how do we want to make our contribution, that sort of thing. We're all engaged with that. And so adults can, in many ways, can help children by just simply engaging with those questions for themselves, but then sharing that with young people. So that there will be a lot of homeschooling families that, because the kids are not shut off in school away from these concerns, the kids are joining in whatever the work is, you know, meaning that the family is in some way volunteering somewhere or whatever it might be, and the kids are getting to do that, or at the very least they're aware of it. So that, you know, a mother at home who has decided that she wants to take up a particular activity, you know, learn a musical instrument because she's always meant to do that, should just do it for her own because she actually wants to. Whereas if she's doing that because she thinks it would be a good example, but she actually finds it miserable and she's resenting it and gritting her teeth, there's no need for that. You know, whatever the mother takes up because she truly wants to and cares about it, that will be important. So the example you were referring to about my writing, I am a writer. That's what I happen to do for a living, and it's what happens to be, you know, the thing that I care about and am drawn to. And so I then extend that mentoring to young people in that, you know, as someone who is a working writer and who is then willing and delighted to devote some time to sharing that and passing that on and helping young people with their own writing. But naturally, you can imagine it would be certainly absurd for me to do any kind of writing just so that it would be a good example for young people. The point is that one has so many good examples as it is. You have your own work and concerns, and then you're just working on making that visible. Work is so often stigmatized for young people in one sense because we have a historical, well, fact, I guess, or situation where compulsory schooling laws were ostensibly instituted to protect young people from being exploited at work, you know, from having absolutely no protection and spending many, many hours working in the factories and so forth. And so the idea was that, I mean, the thing was that we made it compulsory. Instead of saying, well, it's illegal to impose these kinds of working conditions on children, we made it that it's illegal for them not to go to school. So we kind of did it the other way. But meanwhile, on the one hand, there's the very important issue of exploitation and the need to avoid that. On the other hand, though, in a very different kind of way, there is young people's real desire to do what matters, to be in there doing the things that adults find important. You know, people, I bet anyone hearing this can think of a story of a toddler, you know, 2 or 3-year-old who rejects the toy, is not interested in playing with a toy when the adults are doing some real thing nearby. You know, that the little kid wants to get his or her hands on those things that the adults are clearly using for their own real work and concerns. And so the question is, do we shut kids out of that? Do we always try to kind of deflect them by giving them, you know, a toy version of the thing? Or do we try to help them to join in and participate in whatever ways that they can? And then when you get up to teenagers, where people talk a lot about teenagers' alienation from the adult world and so forth, well, we alienate them by putting them in special places called schools and saying only after quite a long time of preparation can you get out and join what we, it's no surprise, call the real world, or what students will jokingly say, when I get out and join the real world. And the premise of homeschooling, of growing without schooling as a teenager, is that you don't have to wait to join the real world. And for that matter, that the real world is not any one thing, that you get to figure out what you think that means. And so you're getting to do things that matter. Real work, as one young person defined it, and I'm sure she's not the first to do this, but is work that if she didn't do, someone else would have to do it. So that this young person was volunteering at a nature education center kind of a thing. And she was doing this as a pretty young child, actually about 7 or 8, and she was given tasks to do that were not necessarily extremely complicated tasks, but she knew that they were real because if she didn't do them, if she wasn't in there that day to do them, one of the other people there, an adult, would have to do it. You know, they were real in that sense. So that, you know, it's interesting, at the Holt Associates office, young people were always desperate to, you know, always asking if they could run the photocopier, put letters through the postage meter, all those kinds of things that they saw us doing. They could tell that stuff mattered, you know, folding letters to go into an envelope for a mailing was very different from just sort of randomly folding paper. It had that aura of real adult stuff surrounding it. And so, I mean, these are just some examples of many, but absolutely Growing Without Schooling magazine was always full of stories of young people working with adults in almost any capacity you could imagine. You know, I mentioned veterinarian's office, volunteering in labs, working with artists, political campaigns, you know, almost anything that they might be interested in, there can be a way to get involved with people who are doing that sort of thing.
They offered me the office, offered me the job. They said I'd better take anything they got. Do you want to make tea at the BBC? Do you want to be? Do you really want to be a cop? Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to keep you up the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. I hate the army and I hate the opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to kick you out the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to kick you out the door. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU. Halloween. A story. One day, two children were walking along the road past some bushes. In the night time, they were going trick-or-treating. Something glittery moved in the bushes. Something red. Red eyes glowing out. And the children ran, and they ran and ran. And suddenly it jumped out. But some people had noticed it, so it jumped back into the bushes. It seemed to come on Halloween, and sometimes it would come out very early morning. One morning, the children were walking to school, going past the bushes. They were still a bit scared. They were not sure if the vampire was still there. And suddenly, something jumped out. And it gave a big roaring gallop, faster than a dog or a horse. And it ran. Each step had a gallop coming through. And its roars made the children not want to look back. The house was about a mile down the road. they began to gallop, running, and then they finally reached their house and they shut the door and bolted it. And the monster, which was a vampire, went away. They felt something queer move around the house. Oh! And there was a glint of red behind the piano that her older sister was playing on. Something red moved out. Something big, gigantic jaw. And it had a tooth that was blood red. And the rest were all yellow. And there was one big pointy one coming all the way up, touching the lip. And it was ferocious. Suddenly there was a loud scream from the older sister's piano teacher. The piano teacher had been bitten. They quickly got into the car and moved away. In 10 seconds, they were out of the house. And the piano teacher was very, very scared. And she never came back to anybody's house again.
The April Ghost from Oak Bay, Victoria, British Columbia. The young woman startled George Drysdale. He hadn't seen her come in, but suddenly there she was, standing just a few meters away on the golf course, with her arms reaching out to him. Drysdale was frightened. He turned to get away from her, but there she was again, standing right in front of him. Frantic, Drysdale changed direction several times, but no matter which way he turned, she was there, facing him, dressed in white and looking terribly sad. Then, as suddenly as she'd appeared, she was gone. Taking a few deep breaths to release the terror that had been building inside him, Drysdale headed back to where his sister and her friends were standing. They had seen him trying to avoid the woman and were wondering what had been going on. After he told them what had happened, they agreed that no human being could move as fast as she had. Who was the woman they had all seen? They could think of only one possible explanation for the eerie event on that moonlit spring night. George Drysdale of Toronto, visiting his sister in Victoria, had just met up with the April Ghost. The ghost got her nickname because ever since 1936, people have reported seeing her in early spring, most often in April. She's also been dubbed the Golf Course Ghost because she's usually seen walking across the Royal Victoria Golf Course near the ocean's edge every now and then. She has also been spotted on a nearby road that winds along the coast. The ghostly young woman usually wears a long white dress that to some looks like an old-fashioned wedding dress. The dress's outlines are fuzzy, giving her a spooky, rather wispy look. The April Ghost has been seen moving about on the golf course as early as 5 p.m., but she seems to prefer visiting late in the evening, an hour or two before midnight. Her scariest appearances have her materialized suddenly, rushing up to someone as if looking for help or warning the person about some nearby danger, and then melting into thin air. George Drysdale seems to have met her doing this over and over again, but why would such a restless spirit haunt a calm, quiet place like a golf course? Perhaps the answer to that may be found in the golf course past. When the body of a woman was found there, buried in a sand trap, the dead woman was identified as a nurse named Doris Gravelin, and she had been brutally strangled. She had last been seen walking on the golf course with her husband, Victor, the evening before she was killed. Doris and Victor were known to have fought a lot and were not living together at the time of her death. Right from the start, the police saw Victor as their prime suspect, but they never got a chance to charge him with his wife's murder. While they were building a case against him, he drowned himself in the waters of Oak Bay, just along the shore by the golf course. Not long after, reports started coming in about a mysterious woman in white haunting the area. Local believers say Doris must be the April ghost, but is she running to people for help or warning them to stay away from a place where such terrible things happen? Both theories are popular, and there is even a third idea about what she's up to. According to some, it's usually couples who aren't married that report seeing her, as George Drysdale did, rushing forward with outstretched arms and then disappearing. Perhaps she is trying to warn couples about the dangers of a bad marriage like her own. The end.
The monster. Once upon a time, one kid, she was very pretty, but the troubles she had in her house. Oh, she had flaming red hair, and she always wore gloves, leather, thick leather gloves, so nothing could bite her. Once she was walking down Mercy Street, and she came across a snake. She looked at it, bent her head down, and suddenly, just as she was about to put her foot down to walk a few more steps away from it, something happened. Heads from all sides flew out. It was just like magic. And then she thought to herself, I better run for it. It had 50 heads.
What kind of heads?
They all had a different shape on them. Some had squiggly lines, some had straight, perfect lines, some had curvy.
What about triangles and hearts? And triangles,
squares, and all sorts of things, except for hearts. If that snake was bad, it made sense that it didn't have a heart shape. She ran as fast as her leg could carry her. She didn't care about her school books. Oh, she took off her bag and threw it far into the bushes. She ran so hard. She fell in the road and skinned her knee, but she got up and ran. The snake was slithering across the road. She dove into her house, shut the door, grabbed a plank of wood and a hammer and a nail, and began to hammer. Soon she had a little wooden plank on the door crack so that the snake couldn't slip under. And not a moment too soon. For then the snake, he grew bigger and bigger and bigger and so big that she couldn't believe as she saw it stretching around the house. She decided to take a little bit of a risk. She climbed up a ladder that she took out of her wardrobe, opened a trap door in the ceiling, jumped out onto the roof. The snake was just about to grow a bit more so it could come to the trap door. She dove in, landed on the ladder, snapped the door shut, and put wooden boards on it, bolted it shut so it would never open again. She was so brave, she would die if the snake was trying to get her. So then she sat on her bed and wondered what to do. Then she had something. Taking a rope, she went outside and said, "Snake, come and get me." She tied the rope into a lasso and climbed onto the roof. When the snake went to climb onto the roof, she threw it around its neck and tightened it, tying it to the chimney of the house. And all the heads sprouted out again, but more and more ropes were grabbed. She quickly tied a lasso in each one, 50 of them. Then she tightened them and all tied them to the chimney. But more heads sprouted, 70 of them. Then she got more and more and more and more and more ropes. Soon the whole thing was tied to the chimney. Then, with a horrible breaking, crashing sound, the chimney broke. She grabbed onto each lasso so she could hold them and keep them on like leashes. She had a dog, so she was used to that walking of it. Pushing and pulling, pulled the snake towards her axe. She pulled out her pocket knife, searched around until she found the head that had its mouth opened all the time. It was a true head. She pinned it down to the floor of her foot and struck the knife down. The neck flew off, and then she began to chop off more and more and more and more and more and more and more until there was nothing but snake's bums. Then she went inside the house and wiped herself from head to toe, and she lived happily ever after until it happened again. The end. The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.